Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Welcome to the Sydney Unity Day 2021, connecting to ourselves and to others. I have the honour to introduce our guest speaker, Claudia Black, the author of the introduction to the Big Red Book and our fellow traveller. Claudia Black, PhD, is a renowned addiction author, speaker and trainer, internationally recognised for her pioneering and contemporary work with family systems and addictive disorders. Claudia designs and presents training workshops and seminars to professional audiences in the field of family service, mental health, addiction, and correctional services, as well as speaking in public forums about addiction and recovery. Since the 1970s, Claudia's work has encompassed the impact of addiction on young and adult children. She was the first to name and coin the dysfunctional family rules: don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. She broke the barrier and openly discussed physical and sexual abuse in the context of addictive families. I now would like to invite Claudia to please take the spotlight.
Thank you, Oriana. Hello, everybody. Thank you for your patience. I'm speaking to you from Arizona, and we're in the middle of monsoons, and we had an internet disconnect. That could happen again, so I apologize if that does. But let me start again and say, hi, I'm Claudia B., a child from an alcoholic family system. Many of you know me in terms of my professional work, but I keep my professional work very separate from my 12-step work. And so today I'm going to share with you my experience, my strength, and my hope, and speak to you as an adult child from an alcoholic family. As much as I have done a lot of speaking, actually for the last 40 years, to advocate and to give voice to the subject of children of addiction and adult children on a professional level, when I first came into ACA, I couldn't speak. I literally couldn't find my voice. And, oh, I could, you know, read the traditions, and I could, you know, read the problem list or the laundry list. But when it came to talking about myself, the pain was so great that I just couldn't speak. And so I did what you always do in a 12-step program. I kept coming back because that's what you do. And in time, I could say a little bit. I could, you know, complete a sentence or two. And in time, I finally could find my voice. You know, the irony is I began my speaking as a little girl in an alcoholic family. And my parents owned a bar all of my growing up years, a tavern in a very small community of only 500 people. And they had a dance hall that was separate from where they, you know, served their drinks and such. And in that dance hall, they had a stage. And I used to perform little one-girl plays. I would write my own little girl plays, and then I'd perform them for my father and his alcoholic friends. When I came to ACA, what I found was support. I found, maybe even more so important for me, was validation for my experiences as I listened to other people. For me, ACA has been the opportunity, in essence, to put my past into perspective, to put my past behind me in so many ways, to let go of all of those shame-based beliefs, such as who I am isn't good enough, it's not okay to make a mistake, all of those negative beliefs that we've taken on. And for me, it's about taking responsibility for how it is I want to live my life today. My personal work in ACA has been about letting go of a family script, and it's been a generational family script, and today truly having choices. My story began, I was thinking about this today, my story began for me with my dad, and how egocentric that is with an alcoholic story. It seems like it always begins, you know, with the person who was addicted to the drug of choice. But it began in the fact that his family, when he was just in his early 20s, bought him a one-way ticket from the East Coast in the United States all the way to the West Coast, a one-way ticket, because he was in trouble with his drinking, and he was in trouble with what they called his womanizing back there. Well, it didn't take my dad too awfully long to find an adult child who was willing to marry him, and that was my mother, who was 17 years of age. My dad was, even in spite of, I'm sure, addicted at that time, was an industrious young man, and he had a couple different jobs at the same time, but his primary job was that he was a fireman. He was a fire person in a city in Washington State, and he made good friends with another guy who worked in the parks department, and they engaged in a lot of outdoor activities, and one of the things that they would do is they would go backpacking into the mountains. And one of their rituals was when they came out of those mountains, as they would head home over the weekend, was that they'd stop at a particular tavern. The name of the tavern was the Whistling Oyster Tavern. And one day the tavern was for sale. So like two young budding alcoholics, they decided to put their very steady jobs back in the 1950s and pick up their wives and their children. And off we went to live in this little logging town. And these two young alcoholic men would now own a tavern. So it was pretty ideal for them. The first few years, you know, as a little kid growing up, you know, life seemed really okay. And then one day, my dad was in a very fateful car accident. And it was a significant day because what was symbolic about that day is that was the day that my mother would go to work in the bar. And that was the day my mom really never came home. My father quit working. By then, George was so alcoholic, they'd already bought him out of the business. And there were three of us little kids who pretty much raised ourselves with me in the lead. I quickly learned how to take charge. You know, as little kids, really young kids, we would just learn to dress ourselves. And I can remember being in second grade and being sent home from school because I wasn't dressed appropriately, but I did the best I could. And then the addiction escalates. And it's probably easier to describe my childhood when I think of all the different feelings that I had. I grew up, I think the most predominant fear in my life was, the predominant feeling in my life was fear. I lived with the fear that my dad, he would take off. He'd get himself a half case of beer, a full case of beer, and he would just take off. And I didn't know if he was even going to come home or when he was going to come home. And then I lived with this fear because I knew he was drinking and in a car, that he was going to die in a car wreck. And then I lived with the fear that he was just going to die from drinking too much, just that he would just drink himself right to death. And then I lived with the fear that my brother was going to die. I had a brother that had a terminal illness and he would die. I was 15 years of age when he passed away, but all of my growing up years, I knew he had a very shortened life. And that if we got a cold, if we got the measles, that he could just die in a weekend. I lived with fear that my mom couldn't come home from the tavern because there was nobody to relieve her, and we didn't know where my dad was a lot of the times. And then I lived with the fear that my dad would kill us, literally kill us. That came a little bit more in my junior high school age years. And then with the fear that he wouldn't stop his screaming. He just screamed so much of the time. Or that he'd create some kind of embarrassing scene at school or somewhere out in the community. And then heaven help, I lived with the fear that my mom might try and intervene. And then I knew that if she intervened, it would just be so much worse. And then the embarrassment, you know, I don't know about you, but if you come from similar kinds of family to myself, it was as if my dad would go out of his way to create embarrassing incidents. So there were frequently those embarrassing incidents. And then the guilt. And for adult children, so much of the time, our guilt is a false guilt, but we don't know that as a child. The guilt that I couldn't make a difference of what was going on. The guilt that I couldn't take the pain out of this home. The guilt that I couldn't stop what it was that was happening. The guilt that I couldn't make anything any better. I was confused. I didn't understand what was happening, and I didn't know why all of this was happening. But one of my strengths, and we all have strengths, we all have things for which we have been resilient, and or we wouldn't literally be here in this meeting today and this celebration today. For me, one of those strengths, and it would be really important, was I developed some kind of internal boundary where I understood that what was happening in my family that was so painful, one, was very connected to my dad, and that there was something wrong with him. I didn't know what it was. But more importantly, I knew it wasn't about me. And I say that because in the first early years of my life, there were a lot of good things that I got from my dad. So I think I had just a little bit of enough of a sense of self, a little bit enough of being valued, I could make that distinction. What I do want you to notice about all my feelings, though, is I wasn't angry. I wasn't one of those angry kids. And I think, looking back, the biggest reasons for that is there was enough anger in this house. There was enough anger in this house, and my being angry certainly wasn't, in my mind, going to help the situation. And the anger in our house was really represented more in rage versus any kind of healthy anger. So for me, I became one of those things that I wrote about, and that is I became very much a responsible child. I became that six-year-old who acted as if she had the resources of a 12-year-old. I became the 12-year-old who acted as if she had the resources of an adult. In essence, I really partnered with my mom. I partnered with my mom to be able to take on some of the responsibilities that she couldn't. My mom got so she was working 7 days a week. You know, it was so significant when you owned a tavern, and the difference between a tavern and a bar in our country is a tavern only sells beer and a bar sells hard liquor. So they only sold beer and some very, very cheap wine, by the way. They could sell that. And for the first handful of years, the taverns were always closed on Sundays to be able to honor the Sabbath. And then in time, the laws changed. And I can so remember when the tavern wasn't closed anymore, my mom was now working 7 days a week, and she was working 12, 14 hours a day, and she needed help. So I became that helper, and I did the housework, and I did the grocery shopping. I did everything but the cooking. And the irony is I still don't cook today. You know, me in the kitchen is like an oxymoron. It's just, it doesn't work. But somehow she would leave the tavern long enough to come home and feed us kids, and then she'd head back over there. Together, I have to say, my mom and I were a really good team. Also, you know, as that responsible child, I learned how to take charge, and I learned how to be goal-oriented. I was that little girl who at 9 years of age had a flow chart on my bedroom wall, outlining on a daily basis what it was I was to accomplish. Not for myself so much as what I was to accomplish for my mother, what I was to accomplish for the household, what I was to accomplish in terms of my brothers and my sisters. I knew what day of the week I was going to the grocery store. I knew what days of the week I was changing the sheets on the bed. I knew what days of the week my brother and sister were involved in a certain activity. But I was actually smart enough to know that I was nine and that kids needed to play. So there was a Wednesday block from 3 to 5 so that I got to go out and play. Again, goal-oriented, highly structured, but I was also that placating child. I often call them the household social worker, and then I became a professional social worker. But that placating child, my job was to, and I thought, and you know, what I do, and I think what we do is what we need to do for our own survivorship. It's what stabilizes a system to the best that we have the power as we're 5, 10, 15 years of age. But it's really about what I need to do for survivorship. So a part of my other job was my job was to take the pain out of the home. If I can lessen your pain, then I'm not in as much pain. So I would do whatever it is I needed to do. I mean, I would have danced on the rooftop if that's what would have lessened my brother or my sister's pain, my mother's pain. I would do whatever I could to lessen the potential for my father's anger. I would do whatever I could to take care of my brothers and sisters at times of fear, at times of embarrassment, at times of confusion. Again, I was really good at being that placating child, and I was really good at being that responsible child. And those strengths, they gave me leadership ability at school. And then I got a lot of affirmation, you know, because I knew how to, you know, take charge of a project. I knew how to be a class officer. I knew how I was willing to take that kind of leadership role. But what was also true is, particularly as my dad became more violent, there were times where it didn't work to try and take away somebody's pain. It didn't work to, you know, be handling some household responsibility that I really would need to become invisible. The only way I was going to survive this moment was to become invisible. And so there was a part of me, just a small part of me, that would become that lost child or become that adjusting child, move into the woodwork and do not draw any attention to yourself at the moment was the best way to either de-escalate the situation or to take care of myself. And that's what I would do, particularly when my father would go into his rages. There was no taking care of anybody else. There was no, you know, doing anything to attempt to calm him down. Now, the added complexity to all of this is that I had a brother that was dying. And my need to lessen his pain, to bring as much stability, was strongly reinforced because I love my brother. I truly love my brother. And I mean, and when I say I, of course, we can often love our siblings, but I wanted to compensate for the fact that he could no longer walk. In time, he couldn't crawl, that he didn't have the friendships that he had once had, et cetera. You know, on Halloween, I can remember taking, you know, my own pillowcase, and my brother would be in the car, but he couldn't go up to the house anymore and get the candy. And I would take a pillowcase for him. And it was a small town, so everybody knew of him. And I would make sure that he was a part of it. On Valentine's Day at school, when everybody passed out Valentine's, I would create Valentine's so he'd have a bundle of them when I took them home, because kids would gradually forget about him over time. He'd cry a lot when my mom wasn't home, and that was really painful for me. I think one of the more classic stories for me was a time when I was probably about 14, 15 years of age. My dad and I, he liked to go to ball games, and he seemed to enjoy taking me with him. And I enjoyed going to those ball games, and we would travel 30 miles. I'm not quite sure what that is in kilometers, but we would travel a good 35, 40 minutes to get to a ball game, a high school ball game. And then my dad would drop me off, and then he'd go to a local bar. And that's sort of what our going to a ball game is like. And then right before the game was over, he would come back, he'd pick me up, he would watch the last few plays of the game, so he'd have something to talk about. And then on this one given night, we are driving home, we're about 30 minutes away from home, and there's one more bar between the ball game and our house. So my dad pulls into the DB Tavern. He looks at me and he says, Claude, he called me Claude. He said, I want you to take the keys to the car and go home and tell your mom I'm at the DB Tavern. And so it didn't dawn on me to do anything but that, because you didn't question, you didn't say no, you simply responded to exactly what it was that you were told. So that night, behind the wheel of the car, one, I did not know how to drive, but he kept the car running. I drove in and out of ditches. I did not have my headlights on for several miles until another car passed me and I realized I got my headlights on. I'm hysterical by the time I pull into our house. I get into the house. I walk into the bedroom, my mother's bedroom, and I said, Dad's at the DB Tavern and he'll be home in a while. Now, what is also significant about that story is my mom didn't say to me, Claudia, how did you get home? We don't ask and we do not question are the other dysfunctional rules. In my family, I became very skilled at lying because you had to lie to just be able to do normal things, just to be able to do normal things with your friends. And my mother really supported us in the lying as well. She would say, don't tell your dad or tell him such and such, just for us to have somewhat of a normal life. Things get really crazy. But I'll never forget the day, you know, I don't know what's going on or why this is happening, because one, I'm in a community that's also heavily affected by substance use disorders. We have lots of alcoholics here in the small logging community. So I don't see my dad as any different than anybody else, really. But one day, my mother said to me, and she got a smile on her face, and I was in my teenage years, and she said, Claudia, I think I know why it is that your dad behaves the way he does. And I thought, oh my gosh, okay. She says, I think I know. I think that your dad is sick and I think he's dying. And I think that he has a brain tumor and he wants us to hate him before he dies. And I looked at my mother, who now has a smile on her face. I cannot tell you how seldom I ever saw a smile on my mother's face. And I thought, that's the craziest thing I ever heard. But I didn't have an answer. So what was the better answer for that? I wasn't going to take that smile off her face. There was no way I was going to take that smile off her face. So I just nodded. We learn to minimize, we learn to discount, we learn to rationalize. And in this case, it was heavily modeled for me as well. And I suspect for so many of you who are here today, you know, there were good times. You know, there were good times when I would go with my dad in the car, even if it was to a ball game that he didn't even show up to, we would often sing. We had, you know, little songs we sang from one bar to the next. I did a lot of bar hopping in the car with my dad. We would go hunting because we lived in a rural area, and you'd go hunting, particularly when you went hunting for deer. You'd get out of the car. My father always had a half case, either 12 beers or 24 beers with him. He would carry that liquor with him. We'd make our way with loaded guns through the forest, by the way. And then we'd find a stump to sit on. And then we'd chat. Now, for any of you who are hunters, you know we've done everything just wrong here. And I have to say, one, we never shot a deer. Two, we never saw a deer. How were we going to see a deer? They heard us in exactly. So that's my good time with my father, who's heavily impaired. There we are with our loaded guns. And we would do the same thing fishing. We'd take the beer, and then we'd go fishing in the rowboat. But the truth is, I thought I had a good time with him. It was like he likes me. He wants me to be here with him. And I chalked that up to a good time. We'd go Christmas tree hunting. And up the hill, up the mountainside we'd go. And he'd always take another friend or two, an alcoholic friend or two, and several of us kids. And there they'd have their axes flailing above their heads. But we'd get our Christmas tree and we would make it home. When I think about it, it was my father that I got the most affection from. It was my father who hugged me. It's my father who gave me a good night kiss. It was my father who verbally had the ability to say, I love you. I think I was probably 50 years old before I ever heard my mother say, I love you. I might have even been older than that. There was no affection, physical affection from my mom. One, she was busy. She was even maybe more outside of the home. And besides that, I was her partner, not necessarily her child. Well, teenage years would come. My brother died. I was just shy of being 16 years of age, and he passed away very quickly one weekend. I really thought that at the point that my dad, I thought at the point that my dad brother died, that my mom would leave my dad, but she didn't, and I didn't understand that. I was really confused. And then the scenes, whatever control my father had, and I think he tried to maintain control, but whatever control he had, he lost once my brother died. And for me, as a teenager, I really straddled two different worlds. I straddled the world of day and the world at night. Those realities were very different for me. I straddled the world of the weekday versus the weekend. And those are very different realities for me. Now, while I was busy being a class president, or president of the band, or the homecoming queen, or what we call a cheerleader, or head of the debate club. At night, what that meant was, for years, I'd go to bed and I'd cry myself to sleep, literally every night. There came a point shortly after my brother died that my father became so sexually preoccupied with me. He would bring up sex a lot. He would be very graphic about sexual behavior. He would accuse me of being sexual with guys, and he was very graphic in that. And there was a change that he had never previously had been like that. And I didn't trust him. I didn't trust him because he would often come into my bedroom, and that's where he'd have these. I'd be in bed and he'd be standing above the bed saying these kinds of things to me. And I knew that this wasn't my dad. Somehow that who this man was standing above my bed saying those kinds of things to me wasn't my dad. And I was afraid that he was going to sexually molest me. And so I started to take a knife to bed. And I put the knife under my pillow, and then I would, in essence, disassociate. But I had this ritual, and I did a visualization where I would void myself, and I'd start at the top of my head, just like we do with guided imageries when we relax. And I would void myself of any positive feelings that I had about my dad, any caring feelings, any love, and was prepared that if he touched me, I would knife him. Now, I have to say, I'm grateful that he never did. I don't know what I would have done had he, if I would have followed through with that. Unfortunately, it gave me a very good skill in how to disassociate. But I didn't know what else to do, and I certainly didn't tell anybody. I mean, how could you tell anybody? One, there weren't a lot of people running through my life for me to tell that would have believed me to begin with, or that there was just no sense that anything positive could come from that. I had no lock on my bedroom, and I remember asking for a lock, and he said no. And then there were the nights that we'd crawl across the living room floor because we thought he might shoot the windows out. And then there were the nights that he'd be passed out. He was passed out a lot. And he'd go over and check to see if he was dead or alive. And he'd put the hand on the stomach. And then the hand would go down. And the hand would come up. And that was good because I didn't want him to die. You know, I loved my dad. I loved him. But there was something about him that wasn't him anymore. So it was tough. And, you know, I think the tough part about me telling my ACA story is, you know, it's a sad story. I think a lot of our stories are sad stories, and thank gosh, you know, in heaven, we have recovery today. You know, my goal as a kid was, my predominant goal was to get out of town, to leave this little community, that I didn't want to be there forever. And what I'd seen is generations of people staying in this community. And it was just, as I say, 500 people community. But there were only two ways I knew that I was going to get out. So in order to be able to get out of town, there were two things I needed to do. I needed to, one, be sure I didn't get pregnant. So your little 14, 15, 16 year old girls were getting pregnant in this town. That was, again, part of the sort of generation of this town and the previous generations. So I knew that I needed to make sure I didn't get pregnant. And I knew that I needed an education. And I managed to graduate. And to be really honest, I've managed to get through my whole life not getting pregnant. So maybe I've been a little bit too rigid on that rule, but I didn't get pregnant and I got out of town and I did pursue that education. Now, one of the gifts that I got from my father was the expectation for school. He had come from a very poverty stricken, it's called Appalachia in the West Virginia area. As severe poverty stricken, and it still is today. He'd come from this kind of background where education was also a way out for people, and most of them didn't get that education. And so he wanted me to have that. Well, one of the things that he did, bless his heart, is we lived always next to the tavern, in front of the tavern, behind the tavern. And our house was like an extension of the tavern. And so a lot of people from the tavern were forever running through our house. And there was a big piggy bank. And the piggy bank actually was a beer can that a beer distributor would give you. And it'd be like 3 or 4 feet tall. But it was to be a piggy bank. So when you came into our house, you had to empty all the coins in your pocket. And you would put them into what was thought of as Claudia's graduation fund or college fund. And that wasn't enough to send me to college, but it certainly helped me. And what that also said was that the whole town was invested in this one kid maybe making it to school and maybe being able to have a future other than continuing to live in this particular area. I often heard that my job pretty much was to be grateful for what I had. And I tell you, I was grateful for what I had. I had a lot more than a lot of other people had. I went on to school. I was rigidly self-reliant. My self-reliance was based on learning how not to trust. And because, you know, you're going to have to do this on your own. I was driven, and survivorship was the name of the game. And I was running. Now, I had a sense of direction, thank heaven, that being school. Meaning was brought to me by helping others. So I knew I was either going to be a doctor, I was going to be a nurse, I was going to be some kind of helping professional. And I became a social worker. You know, I was going to take care of somebody. Work hard because you have to support yourself. Work hard because you cannot rely on other people. Over the course of these years, I had learned a high tolerance for inappropriate behavior. Let me say that again. I said that a little quickly here. High tolerance for inappropriate behavior, meaning people could do a lot of inappropriate things and or even hurtful things, and I wouldn't see that for what it was, which can certainly set you up for victimization. But again, all of these things we learn. So let me give you an example of how I might go about learning that. As I said, my parents owned a bar. When you're 15 and 16 years of age, there's not a lot to do in small towns back in the, you know, now it's early 60s or mid-60s. Not a lot to do when you're that teenage kid, unless you stayed home and you watched television, or you went out and you got drunk with your friends, or loaded with your friends. Well, I was too scared to do that because you couldn't make any kind of mistake with my dad. And I mean, you feared for violence if you did anything that he perceived as wrong and not okay. So anyway, I'm staying home on a Saturday night. My brother is still with us. So, and he's slightly older than me. He's about 18 months older than me. And then I have a little sister and she is 4 years of age. Well, on this particular night, I have a boyfriend that's with me and he's my brother's age. He's 16 as well. And we have an added piece of entertainment in town that nobody else has. We have the tavern. And on Saturday nights, the tavern can be bustling with people. And this is, by the way, really good. We would sit with our little noses pressed up against the window and we would watch people going into the tavern. And then you'd watch people coming out of the tavern. And then it was a rainy area, the Northwest and the United States. So people really didn't go anywhere. They just went to their cars. Now, what I was going to say is this is really good if you want to develop social work assessment skills. You'd notice what they would do when they went into the cars. They'd either drink hard liquor they couldn't buy in the tavern. They would attempt to be sexual with each other. And or they would argue and fight with each other. And sometimes they did all three. But what was also interesting is you just watch them come out of the tavern with not necessarily their partner, but oftentimes somebody else's partner. So I had this wealth of information about what it was that's going on in my community. Well, as we're sitting there, sort of watching the TV and watching the tavern, the front door of the house flies open. A man I've never seen before in my life is standing in the middle of our living room. He stares at the four of us kids and he says, "Do you have a can of deodorant?" Well, I quickly jumped up and I ran into the bathroom and I got this stranger a can of deodorant. I came back in and I handed it to him. And in the middle of our living room, he sprayed himself with the deodorant. And then he set it down on the coffee table and then he walked out the front door. Well, anyway, we all turned back around to finish watching the television of what's going on at the tavern. That's anyway, except for the boyfriend. The boyfriend isn't raised in a house like this. Took him about 30, 40 seconds, and he finally says, "Hey, Claude." He's still looking at the front door, by the way. "Hey, Claude. Hey, Claude. Claude, who was that man?" I looked at the boyfriend. 30, 40 seconds had passed. My reality quickly changed. I looked at the boyfriend and said, "What man?" He said, "That man that was just here that wanted that can of deodorant." And then I looked at him and said, "Oh, and what's it to you?" You know, it's one of those, you teach that person who doesn't come from this kind of history to not question. And if they learn not to question, they get to stay around. And if they do question, then they get to go. "That man that was just here that wanted that can of deodorant." Totally outside of my reality. That's learning high tolerance for inappropriate behavior. Well, I have to tell you, this young man's name was Mitch, and I would come to marry Mitch. He was my high school boyfriend. And of course I had to marry him because he was the first person who ultimately said to me at a young age, and nobody would say it for many, many more years. He was the first person to say to me, "Claudia, there is something wrong with your father." The first person to ever say that. I loved him. I loved him. And besides that, I was a good adult child. I knew when I married Mitch, and we went together another 3 or 4 years before we married. I knew I didn't want to get married. I loved him, but I also knew he didn't want to get married. I didn't want to get married. I did not know how to say no. In my house, it was never okay to say no. since I was a little girl. It was never okay to say no. It was never okay to think about my own needs and my own wants. And I certainly could not hurt his feelings. And for that, I have felt great guilt in my life. And so with that, we got married. And then we very quickly began to drown together. One, he was a daily pot smoker, and I truly believe he became dependent upon that. Two, when we both finished college, he didn't get a job. He didn't get a job. If you asked me how my marriage was, I would have told you it was fine. I mean, we had no disagreements. We had no disagreements. I had no needs, and my needs weren't getting met. But in my mind, I mean, it didn't dawn on me that I had needs that were not getting met. And then one day, about 3 years into it, I was working. I was working two jobs, in fact, and he wasn't. He was playing a lot of tennis and having a good time and smoking a lot of dope. And one day I had a whole week off to myself, and I started to feel. I started to cry. And at the end of the week, one morning, I woke him up and I said, I need to go now. And he said, where are you going? Like, I'm going to the grocery store by 6 o'clock in the morning. I said, I need to go now. And we broke up that day. There was no negotiation. There was no problem solving. There was no conflict. I can remember one time he became upset with me somewhere in those 3 years. He became upset with me and he raised his voice. All he did was raise his voice. He wasn't calling me names. I don't think he was blaming. He was raised his voice, which is what we do when we have anger. And I backed up away from him and I grabbed my throat. My father used to choke us. And Mitch so kindly said, Claudia, I'm not your dad. I'm not your dad. But I was too afraid of conflict. I was too afraid of any kind of disagreement. And I didn't see negotiation as an option here. I also think that I saw my mother. I saw me 26 years down the road. It took my mother 26 years before she left. And when she left, she really thought she was going to die. She felt she was going to die if she stayed, and she might die if she left. But there was still a might. And I just think I saw myself there, and I didn't have any skills in which to be able to deal with that. Well, we divorced, and I had guilt for a very, very long time for that, for which I needed to make great amends. I don't know what would have happened to the marriage had I been healthier about that, but that is what happened to it. I went on to graduate school. Remember, school was my answer to everything at that point. And I was just living my life. But for the first time in my life, what I do remember when it was Mitch who left that day, what I do remember is that as he left the driveway, I felt like this huge weight was lifted. And I said to myself, I'm no longer going to lie. And I think I meant to myself, I'm no longer going to lie. And I'm no longer going to lie about my mother and my father. And somehow I knew that was connected to that marriage. But I took a class. It was one of the rare things that happened in a college setting. She had a class on addiction. It was actually called alcoholism back then. They didn't use that phrase. And in that class, I learned about blackouts and I learned about personality changes. And for the first time in my life, I understood. My father didn't have a brain tumor. My father wasn't crazy. But what we lived with was alcoholism. And then, heaven help, I took another class. I took a class called psychodrama. It's a form of therapy where you don't talk, but things get acted out. Well, I was really good at talking. And for those of you who are good at talking, we can talk around the issue, but not necessarily speak to the issue. So that was the best kind of really therapy for me. It wasn't meant to be therapy. It was meant to teach us these techniques. Well, I started to cry and I couldn't stop. I'd cry going down the freeway looking at a billboard selling dog food. I was just crying all the time. And I got help, which was huge to get help, a whole novel concept. And I saw a therapist who also didn't do traditional talking therapy. He did something called Gestalt therapy. He quickly, immediately named my issues as trust, control, and dependency issues. Trust, control, and dependency. Well, again, addiction isn't, we didn't know about children of addiction. We didn't really know much about the impact of addiction in the family. But I did know that my dad was alcoholic, and I did know that that was the answer for what it is that had happened in my family. My parents divorced, as I said a few minutes ago. My dad married another woman who owned a bar, but they were both alcoholics, so that didn't work out very long. And then I got out of graduate school and I took a job in the addictions field. Serendipitous, I think it was a God thing. I didn't know anything about treating addiction. I didn't know anything about the recovery field. I just had my own experience and I wasn't even talking about it yet, but I had some insights. I was asked to develop a family program. Well, being young, 25, 26 years of age, I thought, I made assumptions. Also being an adult child, we make lots of assumptions and we don't ask questions. So I made an assumption, I knew what they wanted. So I invited kids in. Well, back then, if you went to treatment, you were of the age, your kids were often adults. So I had a lot of these adult age kids. And then I had a lot of these adolescent age kids. And then I had a lot of these very young kids. And then I had the partners. And then I was also working with those who were addicted. Now, all they wanted me to do was to work with the partners. They weren't asking for all of this. But as I said, I made assumptions and I didn't ask questions. And what I saw was really myself. I saw the progression. I saw that by the time we're 9 years of age, we lose the ability to be honest about what it is we're feeling. The younger that you are, the more honest that you are. And I saw that by the time they got into their 20s, they were already depressed. They were already anxious. They were already in hurtful, painful relationships. Many of them were medicating. They were getting into unhealthy relationships. And emotionally, I saw me in all of that. I saw me in all of that. I identified emotionally with the addicted person, not as an active substance use person, though, but emotionally. And I certainly even identified with the partners of, even if I didn't after the first marriage, you marry somebody with an active addiction. And that's when I began to talk about these issues. I have to tell you, it's easy for me to speak on behalf of those you want to advocate for than to speak for yourself. So, being a responsible social worker, people on my team said you need to refer these partners to Al-Anon. So I thought, well, maybe I should go to an Al-Anon meeting myself just to see what's going on there. And so I did. And I have to tell you, it was the first time in my life I felt at home. I felt at home in my own skin. It was in a traditional Al-Anon meeting. It was funny, they offered me phone numbers. And I didn't talk. I just sat and I felt at home. And they offered me phone numbers and I'm polite. I'm an adult child. So I took them. I had no idea what I was supposed to do with those phone numbers. And I kept going back. And I don't know that I ever talked because I only went back probably for a few months. And then we moved. And then as when I say we, I'd gotten into a relationship and it would be somebody I've been in a relationship with for 40 years. I'll say more about that in just a moment. But my professional work was already in place as I then began to go to ACA meetings. It was in the late 1970s that ACA would begin in New York, which you probably know. It would be another 2 or 3 years before it came to the West Coast. I was a part of starting that first meeting in Orange County, California. But I knew enough then to not, I had a professional thing going on and that I needed this 12-step meeting to be for me in my own recovery process. And so I got two or three other people who understood this concept of an adult child. We started a meeting. We did all the readings. We all agreed to find one more person. Suddenly we had 8 people. And when that happened, I stepped out of any kind of leadership role there. So this meeting could be for me as well as for others. I took that laundry list. And by then I'm traveling across the country. I took it everywhere I could go and gave it to people in their communities. Recovery for me has been more of an emotional and spiritual journey. And I think that is because I didn't have a huge trail of poor decisions behind me, nor did I have active addictions. I certainly had that low-grade depression that they call dysthymia. And I had a whole host of character defects that were waiting for me to act them out, already acted out in my relationship. Again, as I said, speaking is a lot easier for me to advocate for somebody else than for myself. You know, from the moment I walked into ACA, I never felt again like I had to carry the burden of the world. It was there that I really learned about boundaries. And what I mean by boundaries is who is responsible for what. One of the big focuses for me is learning how to say no. Oh my, the people pleaser in me is just huge. It's probably more huge than that responsible child in me. And oh, I needed to let go of perfectionism. You know, my family was not okay to make a mistake. If you did anything less than perfect, somehow you got the message that you were not okay. And oftentimes you got the message in a real physical way that you were not okay. There was no room for mistakes. And so for me, what I did is I pushed to excel to be the best, with fear and shame nipping at the seat of my pants the entire time. And the problem with that is no matter how well you do something, it is never good enough. It is never good enough. It is never good enough because the it is not about me. It was about my dad's need for control. It was about my dad's, you know, tyrannical behavior about whether or not I got approval by how well I did or did not do something. I always say that for those of us who are perfectionists, we operate at 150%. If you let go of 50%, you're still doing quite well. So that's how I began. Let go of 50%, Claudia, you're still doing quite well. But it was in the 12-step program, as I said, I would start to feel safe enough to be able to set limits, to be able to say no. Saying no is really about saying yes to myself. It was in the 12-step programs I would learn to let go. You know, we operate from, I'm either in let go of control. I'm either in total control or I have no control whatsoever. I always say recovery is learning the not, is learning the word some. Yes.
5 minutes. 5 minutes.
Okay. I'm aware of the time. Okay. So I was saying recovery is learning the word some, and it's also learning, you know, getting out of the numbers 1 and 10 and being able to work with the 2 through 9. I think that for me, ACA is about connecting my head, my heart, and my soul. And I have to say that when I came in, my head was very heavy and my heart and soul were very, very weary. It's not been an easy process, and this recovery has taken a lot of time. But the crisis of it, for me, there was hope from the beginning, just from the very beginning. You know, even into my 30s, I came into recovery in my mid-20s, but even into my 30s and my 40s, I would have night terrors. I have been known to wake up in the middle of the night and blood-curdling screams. That hasn't happened for a lot of years now, but that would happen for a lot of years. So again, it isn't something that comes real quickly for us. But in that process, you know, then I had a place in which to talk about it. I've had to learn a lot of mindfulness practices. I've had to learn how to sort of emotionally regulate myself, they say. Part of that is learning how to play. When you're a serious kid and you're a play kid, or you don't know how to play. Today, I have a great child spirit and have I have a very natural inner child, and I know you have a workshop on that today. That really pleases me. Today, I know that who I am is good enough. And, you know, the internet goes out and I don't get on, and it's like, oh, I don't like this. But the world didn't come to an end, and it didn't come to the end with the community that I was working with. Today, I have, my father died of his alcoholism, by the way, and DTs. I had a wonderful dream after he died. I dreamt in my dream that he went to an AA meeting, and I was striving to get into this meeting. I was striving to get into, and I had all these barriers, and he got to the meeting on his own. I thought that was just a wonderful piece here. I want to say that, because I can't not say this. I've been married for 40 years. It was a good marriage. I say that we were both adult children, and we both had recovery. He also had recovery from his addictions. He was 5 years sober when I met him. And I think I was willing to make another commitment to a marriage because I felt that we were both open to problem solving. And if we had a problem, that somehow we would work it out. And we did. And he passed away 4 years ago. It's been a very tough time. But he went with grace, and I think it was because of his program. And I think I've handled things rather well, and it's probably because of my program. When it comes to relationships, as long as I don't abandon myself, and I'm not talking about necessarily intimate relationships, but certainly that. But when it comes to friendships and relationship with family members and intimate relationships, as long as I do not abandon myself, I think my other relationships will all fall into place. I'm very grateful for the 12-step program of ACA. I'm very grateful for my own recovery. I do not live in fear. I do not live in anguish. I do not expect the worst. I have choices. I take responsibility for my own behavior today and spiritually. I love my God, and I feel very, very blessed. And ACA has given me. If I can attribute to anything, ACA has given me that. It has given me the safety in which to find my voice. And I want to thank you all for being a part of that. Thank you.
Thanks, Claudia.
Thank you.
Thank you, Claudia. 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 Thank you, Claudia